This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Henry Louis Gates has been writing about race and culture in an ongoing series of fascinating articles in The New Yorker magazine. Gates chairs the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard. He's an editor of the new Norton Anthology of African-American Literature and the Dictionary of Global Culture. And he has a new book called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, a collection of his New Yorker pieces, including profiles of Louis Farrakhan, Colin Powell, and Harry Belafonte. The title piece is about interpretations of the O.J. Simpson criminal trial. Gates told me he knows a lot of people who thought Simpson was guilty after the criminal trial and changed their minds after the civil trial.
Most of the people I talked to about the O.J. verdict when I was writing the piece for The New Yorker were people like my barber, my daughter's hairdresser, a secretary at the office. I wanted to know what just regular people thought about O.J., shoeshine people, people on the streets, some of the homeless people. I interviewed all these people because I initially planned to do a piece like that, sort of the person on the street kind of piece, but the black person on the street or the person within the working class of the African-American community. And everybody within that group had a theory about the mafia doing it or that there was some conspiracy or Mark Furman and his buddies had set O.J. up. So I went back to a lot of these people I see on a regular basis in the grocery store or in the daily course of a week. And nobody, I repeat, nobody is defending O.J.'s innocence now. I think shoes did the brother in.
It was funny, you know, you wrote a little bit about conspiracy theories and you described them as being irresistible labor-saving devices in the face of complexity. I thought that was very interesting way of putting it.
Well, one of the things that I tried to point out was that the black community has been in the grip of conspiracy theories for generations and generations. I think because of the particular history of oppression of black people in this country, the degree of conspiracy theories is probably cubed compared to that in the rest of the population, whether crack was a conspiracy by the CIA or AIDS was a conspiracy to wipe out the African-American male, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But whether or not there really was a conspiracy, when people look around and look at the state of Afro-America, they see devastation and they reach for large-scale, sometimes fantastical explanations to account for that kind of terror and pain, and both of which produce an enormous amount of anxiety.
In your piece about O.J. after the criminal trial, you wrote that your worst fear is to have to go before the criminal justice system. Why is that your worst fear?
Well, I think that we all have that fear. I wrote that just after the section in the essay when I'd interviewed so many of my friends, people like William Joyce Wilson or Cornel West, Anthony Appiah, and asked them if they had had brushes with the police. And they said, looked at me like I was crazy and said, of course we've all had brushes with the police. And so, of course, have I. I worry about being a black person victimized by a racist jury. And I think that could happen to any of us. If I see a flashing light in my rearview mirror, panic and terror set in. And it doesn't matter, I think, whether you are a wealthy person, whether you have a group of credentials as long as you are as your arm. When you think about Rodney King, you think, there but for the grace of God go I. And I still feel that way. When I moved to Lexington, Massachusetts, which is, I no longer live there, but it's a wonderful upper middle class suburb, about 25,000 people, I found an excuse to go by the Lexington Police Department to let them know that it was I who would be driving through there late at night on my way home, not somebody who was on the prowl trying to rip off the local wonderful inhabitants of Lexington, Massachusetts. It's a very embarrassing thing to admit. It's a humiliating thing to have to do, but I admit it and I did it. And I think it's that kind of paranoia or that kind of response that results from terrible experiences with the police being, we call it DWB, driving while black, that leads to all sorts of aberrant behavior.
So what kind of response did you get from the police when you notified them you were moving in?
Well, when I would drive through Lexington late at night, there was a police officer there. He would wave to me, and I would wave to him right after I tooted my horn at him, just reminding him of who I was. But again, I feel so vulnerable, and I think this is true of other African-American males, when you're pulled over by a policeman. They can do anything to you. They can make any claim. They can plant things on you. And if we think that's paranoia, just ask Mark Furman.
Henry Louis Gates is my guest, and his new book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, is a collection of pieces that he's written for The New Yorker magazine. You know, we recently broadcast the town hall debate in New York about race, cultural power, and theater, a debate between August Wilson, a playwright who's African-American, and Robert Brustein, a theater critic and director who's white. And your latest New Yorker piece was about that debate and about the black theater that's kind of left out of that debate. The debate is about whether African-Americans in theater should stick to theater that's written, directed by, and stars blacks, and if they sell out their cultural identity by participating in predominantly white theater. Your piece was about that debate, but also about what's being called the new Chitlin circuit in theater. And I'd like you to describe what that circuit is.
African-American culture has always had its own organizations, its own forms, its own social structures. I mean, it had to have. The people from slavery times couldn't participate in the outlets of the larger society, and so they formed their own. They formed their own rituals to get married. They formed their own social clubs, fraternities, sororities, churches, and as it happens, their own theaters, their own forms of entertainment. And you cut to the 1920s, an organization called TOBA, which was nicknamed Tough on Black Asses, formed a black national theatrical network that would feature plays and comedy routines and blues singers, classical blues singers like Bessie Smith and Mamie Smith, jazz groups, every possible form of entertainment that you can think of in the secular world. And this was called the Chitlin Circuit. It would come to Cumberland, West Virginia, where my father was a boy, in the following form. There were no black buildings, no buildings owned by black people. So they would rent one of the local ballrooms or the local auditorium at the colored school or something like that. If they rented a movie theater or an organization that had another life in the daytime, they would wait until, say, midnight and have an all-colored show. And so my father saw Duke Ellington and Count Basie there in midnight performances that would go on to 2 or 3 o'clock, and they would sell fried chicken and baked sweet potatoes and chitlins. And so it was called the Chitlin Circuit.
What's the new Chitlin Circuit like in the theater?
Well, the new Chitlin Circuit, the first time I heard about this, frankly, was from my buddy Cornel West, who told me about a play that he had gone to see with his wife in Philadelphia called Only the Strong Survived. And I said, well, who wrote that? He said, well, nobody wrote it. You would not know who wrote it. But the point is, everyone in the black community, working class black people, flocked to see plays like Only the Strong Survive. And then he told me about the plot, and we both cracked up. It was just funny. He said risque humor and sexual and gendered stereotypes, and he said it was enormously popular. So I filed that away for about a year, and then Brustein and August Wilson get into this debate. And I think about the sort of things that August Wilson is demanding, that black theater by us, for us, and about us, echoing unwittingly, no doubt, the call in 1926 by W.E.B. Du Bois for an all-black theater, what he called a Negro theater. So I was thinking about how would that be funded? And then I remember what Cornell said about this play called Only the Strong Survive, and I start making a few phone calls, and I find out that there is a play called My Grandmother Prayed for Me, playing at the Newark Symphony Hall, and I jump on a plane one Sunday afternoon, and I land in at the Newark Airport, and I take a car over to the Newark Symphony Hall, and there, along with 3,000 people, on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, each of us paying $24.50, I watched one of the funniest, most hilarious, off-color, risque, melodramatic, corny, kitschy, schlocky works of art that I'd ever seen, and it was My Grandmother Prayed for Me. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these plays, and they're playing the packed houses from coast to coast. That is the contemporary Chitlin Circuit. They're either kitschy, schlocky comedies or embarrassing melodramas involving God and angels and crackheads and inner city despair, all of which is mysteriously, magically cured through a miracle by a God who manifests himself either in his own person or through one of his angels. It was amazing.
Now you write that these shows kind of make the TV series Good Times look like Strindberg.
That's right.
And you also say that all the very worst stereotypes of African-Americans are on display here, larger than life. What kind of stereotypes did you see?
A large woman who's the grandmother, who is overly religious. Gendered sexual stereotypes are there. Gay stereotypes about limp wrist gay men, hypersex black women, hypersex black men, affinity for drugs, laziness, shiftlessness. They're all there. I mean, as I say in the piece, had a white person written this, Jesse Jackson and the NAACP would have linked arms and called us all to boycott that kind of work. But of course, a white person didn't write it. It was an act of the community for the community, and the community comes out in droves to laugh at itself and even a stereotypical representation of itself.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. His new collection of New Yorker articles is called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Henry Louis Gates, we're talking about his recent New Yorker article on race and theater. So what does it say for you that, you know, while August Wilson is calling for a theater that's by blacks and about African Americans, his theater is actually seen, I think, by a predominantly white audience, but the audience that's really turning out for African American theater, the African American audience that's turning out, is turning out for an African American theater that is, yes, it's black themed, but as you say, it's really kind of schlocky and stereotyped.
Well, I wanted to put the lie to the notion that black people don't go to theater, just like a few years ago, it was commonly thought among publishers that black people didn't buy books. And last year, we know black people bought 160 million books. Black people, we know, also flock to the theater. They just don't flock to Broadway. And the reason it was important to do that is that August Wilson's argument turned on the government or private philanthropies subsidizing black theaters in cities with a population of over 60%. And it seemed to me that that's not the way to build a solid theatrical base. In fact, that's why I cited the relationship between the Ford Foundation and the Negro Ensemble Company and the New Lafayette Theater in the 1960s. I set it up as an allegory to say that, look, it didn't work then. It's not going to work this time. We need to subsidize theater in the way that everybody's theater is subsidized, which is from various sources. One from the board of directors, one from the federal government, obviously to less and less extent over the last few years, and from people just reaching into their pocket and paying for tickets. And our people will do that. We have established that they would do that. They just won't do it for August Wilson's plays. So the challenge implicitly that I tried to pose to August and for those of us, including me, who want to see strong, healthy cultural institutions within the African-American community, is for us to figure out how to get the people who sat around me at the Newark Symphony Hall in to see Fences or Two Trains Running or whatever the play might be. That is the challenge.
But it's the same thing as, like, more people are going to go see Cats than Stephen Sondheim. I mean, you know, I think in a lot of ways people have romanticized what it means to make art for the people. And whenever this kind of almost ideological sense of, like, populism and democracy enters art, it sometimes gets really confusing because it's often true that the art that reaches the most people isn't necessarily a politically populist art. It's kitsch.
Oh, without a doubt. But I want to see black cultural institutions, those people responsible for appealing to or attempting to attract a black popular audience into theaters, to begin to analyze what it is that black people respond to. We have a tremendously sophisticated sense of taste when it comes to music, for obvious reasons. And we have had a sophisticated sense of music for a very long time. I mean, no one passes off kitschy music to African Americans. I mean, they understand what's good and what's not, and that's good. We don't have that counterpart or that equivalent of the sophistication and taste in our theatrical realm. So why not have a theater that uses the advertising seduction techniques used on the Chitlin Circuit, which I just describe in the piece, as well as different kind of programming? I mean, high art, middle brow art, and rank lowbrow art, meaning Moms Mabley and Red Fox, both of whom, by the way, were, I think, geniuses and products of the Chitlin Circuit. There's nothing wrong with that. I think that just as in the 1960s, we accepted the notion that the people were ignorant and they had to understand the new black political manifestos being produced by artists such as Leroy Jones, who's now a Mary Baraka, or Ed Bullins, and this is by their own admission, by the way. And they had a very arrogant attitude toward the African American community. So too, I think, 30 years later, we have an arrogant attitude toward people telling them that they don't know what they like or they shouldn't like what they do like, and we haven't figured out how to transform that impulse to go to the theater onto a higher level. That is what I think the challenge is, and that's why I ended the piece with a quotation from Ed Bullins, who's right here in Boston at Northeastern and is, I think, a very sophisticated playwright, who is trying to get his plays on that Chitlin circuit to tap into that potential audience, a large audience, much larger than any other theatrical audience in the history of the black community.
It would be interesting to see what happens, to see if the people respond to his plays.
Yeah, you don't seem very optimistic.
Well, I don't know. It seems like 4 years in many different cultures, people have felt if only excellent art had the right advertising or the right positioning that everybody would flock to see it. I'm not always convinced that that's true.
Well, I agree with you there, but I think that there is always a segment of an audience as large and as diverse as the one that I've just described that wants a bit more, wants something more sophisticated. And I think that's where Bullen's potential resides.
I wonder where you see yourself as a writer fitting into this debate about what art truly speaks to the community. I mean, I have heard people say about you, oh, Henry Louis Gates, he doesn't really speak for the African-American community.
Well, they're absolutely correct. I'm just trying to speak for myself.
Right.
I can't, I don't want the burden of being responsible for or accountable to 35 million other African Americans. I mean, that's not my job. That's not my profile. It's hard enough to figure out what you believe about an issue and then to shape it into some sort of meaningful form without worrying about, will I offend the black community or will what I write be harmful to the black community? You have to be free to call it the way that you see it. What I try to do is replicate the effect of that conversation within the race, as my father might say, but for a broader audience. And I think that's what art does. I think that the genius of James Joyce is that he writes with enormous particularity about the customs and mores of a stratum of the Irish community early in the century. But that is merely backdrop for larger, more fundamental questions. It's the same way that Shakespeare used Denmark, right? Do you read Hamlet to learn about the order of succession of Danish kings? I mean, absolutely not. You read it to learn about basic fundamental human emotions. And to a much lesser extent than God knows James Joyce or William Shakespeare, as a journalist, I am trying to unveil, to use Du Bois's great metaphor, a life within the race for a larger audience, and to do that with as much freedom and effectiveness that I, with my own limitations, can muster. That is the challenge of each of these pieces to me. I mean, that is what my... It's almost as if I feel that I have a mission. And that mission, not to be corny or to make too big a point of it, but my mission is to record my generation of African-Americans for posterity and for my contemporaries in the larger society. And that's why a piece like the Chitlin Circuit excited me so much, because here's something that the larger culture didn't know about. I could report on it. In fact, many African Americans didn't know about it. And I can report on it, but then use it to talk about larger issues of theater and representation, authenticity, interracial debates, new forms of casting, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, one of the things that you revealed, which I had no idea about in your piece about African American theater in the Chitlin Circuit, is that some of the plays in the theater circuit are basically produced by drug dealers. That the money backing some of these shows is drug money. And one playwright who wrote a play that was produced in such a way said, you know, that he really had a problem, because here he was writing a play about all the things that are killing African-American men, and of course the play is being subsidized by drug money. I mean, what bigger paradox is there? What reaction did you get to this revelation?
That was James Chapman, who wrote a very popular play called Our Young Men Are Dying and No One Seems to Care. And, again, I'm just working my way through this world. And he starts to tell me all these experiences, which I put in the piece, about running up against drug dealers and enormous amounts of cash. Because these guys, one, have to launder their money, or I don't know if that's laundering money, but moving one large source of cash from here over to there. And also wanting to make money, large sums of money, in ways other than dealing drugs. And he said that there was so much money being made on the Chitlin circuit that these guys had enough cash to rent a hall. They would go and look at them. They would sit through a production of Beauty Shop or whatever the play might be, and they, or else they would hire one of the people who had written one of these plays and say, write me a play, and then they would put it on. They would hire the actors, and they would make enormous amounts of money, too. I was astonished at how much money was being made on the Chitlin circuit, and I think that that would help to motivate many of the other artists to try to emulate the techniques of marketing in the Chitlin circuit, because they want to make that money too. But Chapman's description made me realize how dangerous it was and how corrupt that world can be. I think that there's a sort of different degrees of excellence or sophistication within the Chitlin circuit. On the high end, you have people like James Chapman and Shelley Garrett, the author of Beauty Shop, which is the all-time champion of the Chitlin circuit proceeds. And on the lower end, I'm afraid you have this element that Chapman describes in my piece.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. He has a new collection of New Yorker articles called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Henry Louis Gates is my guest. His new book, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, is an anthology of essays that he's written for the New Yorker magazine. The theme of so many of your pieces is the meaning of racial identity at the end of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
You came of age yourself at a period of great racial consciousness and identity. For, you know, it was a period of great African-American consciousness-raising militancy, a period of feminism, the beginning of the gay rights movement. When you were in college in the late 60s, early 70s, it was the When the Revolution Comes era.
That's right. Good old days.
Yeah. No, I'm wondering how coming of age during a period of such radicalism and often of such kind of ideology and towing the line-ism affected your view of politics, culture, and the arts. I mean, your view of where ideology began and what was dangerous about towing the line.
Well, I think that I was blessed by coming from a background in the country, a rural background, so that I would go up to I was a student at Yale, as you know, and there was all of this political rhetoric, and I was so eager to be black, quote-unquote, to be an authentic black person. And I knew whatever I'd come from in the hills of West Virginia could not possibly be authentic blackness. So I got my dashiki, and I grew my afro. I had an afro by the time I got to Yale, but I let it grow more, and I volunteered to be secretary of the Black Student Association, the political organization, so I would be the scribe of the revolution, and I could learn the lines, you know, I could watch it up close. And the difference between the way people talked in a political meeting and what they allowed themselves to say and cheer and applaud, and then what they said behind closed doors or what they said when they were back with their parents during the holiday, really threw me for a loop. I would go back and repeat some line to my father and my mother, and my mother would say, Skippy, you can't really believe that, do you, baby? You know, like, are you out of your mind? And
give me an example.
They're not easy, quick things, though, but they're things like, well, we're going to take over. Black people are going to all rise up. You know, we're going to defend ourselves against the police, and maybe we'll colonize a state, or and if it doesn't work out, if they don't give us our rights, we're all going to split and go back to Africa. And, you know, my father would say, compared to what? You know, like, are you out? Are you crazy? You know, we're not going anywhere. There ain't going to be no revolution. The white man's going to wipe out your revolution in about 15 seconds. You better study that calculus and physics and get yourself to medical school and stop hanging around with all these black people with big afros and dashikis like you have on. I think that I grew skeptical of, I mean, we were all just kids, and but we believed. And what I tried to retain was that sense of concern, that sense of service for the African-American community, which is what this was all about, mm-hmm, for our generation of college kids, but to discard the rhetorical baggage. And more particularly in my case, and I think that this is something, or I hope this is something that comes out in my pieces, to attack and to challenge ideological bullies whenever they manifest themselves. And those are the people I can't stand, and I'm always going to attack them, because I think that if there are 35 million African Americans, there are 35 million ways to be an African American, to be black, and that no one has a right to insist that someone else is inauthentic with their blackness. What blackness is the sum total of what we all are individually as a people, rather than the other way around, that someone issues a memo and says, this is what blackness is today, and you have to repeat this after me. That kind of groupthink, I think, is disgusting.
Well, Henry Louis Gates, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Henry Louis Gates has a new collection of essays called 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. He chairs the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard.